Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special discussion with Chris Davis. I'm John Matthews, Head of Private Wealth Management at UBS here in the United States, and thank you all for joining us yet again for another one of our Private Wealth exclusive calls today. Well, today I'm very excited to be joined by Chris Davis, who happens to be a good friend of mine. Chris is the chairman and portfolio manager for Davis Advisors, a pillar on the Wall Street investment management community for sure, and also serves on many boards, including Berkshire Hathaway and Coca-Cola. Maybe we'll talk about Berkshire Hathaway in a little bit, Chris. But Chris, I'm excited to talk to you today about your 36-year career at Davis and how you're advising clients today. And you and I have talked a lot about this, and I think today is an important time to talk about the environment that we're in. It's not the same, I think, as it has been. But not only will we be talking about investing, but also about life and living. So let's dive in. Chris, you come from three generations of wealth advisors. Your grandfather, your father are both famous investors as you. But before we begin, can you provide us with maybe a quick level set and tell us a bit about your background? You didn't start out in finance. And in fact, I know you grew up getting your hands dirty when maybe some others would have thought you would have had a different path. But so maybe start with a bit of your background and how you got to where you are.
Well, I was lucky to grow up with both a father and grandfather that loved what they did. But even though they loved it, of course, being a kid, you want to find your own way. And so I tried a few different things, but I really got my hands dirty probably working at the Bronx Zoo. I had wanted to be a vet, and I started as a kid. You couldn't have a paper route in New York City, but I had a dog walking service from the time I was about 10. So the pooper scooper laws came into effect while I had my dog walking service. So getting your hands dirty is a little too literal for me, but I went on and worked some at the Bronx Zoo. I was actually in seminary for a time. But it was really clear to me that, you know, I grew up surrounded by this idea that investing is not about numbers in a newspaper squiggling around. It's really about people and businesses and ideas and analysis and research. And it's just so exciting and so interesting. And to have two role models that loved it, it proved irresistible, despite my attempts at becoming a large animal veterinarian.
Well, you're obviously a great value investor. You learn, and that's bottom-up stock picking. You learn from the bottom up, which is, I think is great.
It's a little dark, but and somebody also told me working at the Bronx Zoo was a good way to manage a trading desk. Yeah, and there's some truth to that.
Probably even better. Well, I think that's fascinating because a lot of people don't know that. I think our backgrounds determine so much about who we end up as people. And I respect that so much in you. You probably could have gone another direction, but you wanted to work. Yeah. And I think instilling that kind of work ethic values probably what made you into a person you are today.
So. Well, you know, kids watch what you do. They don't listen to what you say. And for a long time, they will define themselves in opposition. But I do think that over time, that sort of modeling of happy and substantial and engaged lives, I mean, that was an enormous gift to me from both my father and my grandparents.
Right. So tell us a little bit about the firm, your investment process, how you guys think about investing, and then we'll get into some questions.
Well, look, like you said, John, it traces back really to the late 1940s. That's when my grandfather started in the investment business. And it was a second career for him, too. He had actually worked in public policy and international relations. So he was in his late 30s. And he started with this sort of premise of, what is the best way to compound wealth? He talked about generational wealth. And he had come from the Midwest, from Peoria, but his namesake was a great man in Illinois. And I think through the generations, whatever wealth had been made had been dissipated. And so he had this idea of how do I build it back? And of course, he said the real secret is to be an owner, not a lender, mm-hmm. right? You want to be an owner of businesses. And so he had this idea, the best way to build generational wealth is to be an owner, to be an equity owner. So we became equity specialists with a really research-driven approach that was very long-term oriented. And, we ended up in sort of a funny hybrid, because before there was a distinction between growth and value.
Right.
We sort of had a mindset that we want to own businesses that can compound for decades. So they have to be high quality, resilient, they have to be durable. But we know that a good business can be a lousy investment if you overpay. So evaluation discipline has always been central to what we do. So it was a research-driven, long-term approach based on analysis and the idea of generational wealth building. And that continued in with my father, who launched our mutual funds, which was the first way that we sort of came out to what I'd call the general public from institutions and endowments. And that's really what has been the sort of traced the path all the way up to the present and the firm as it is today.
Yeah, so you've continued kind of that original thinking from your grandfather and father and continue today with some tweaks from you, I would assume.
Absolutely, but with the core values of deep research, analysis, long-term compounding, combining quality with evaluation discipline, and of course, importantly, having our money invested side by side with clients. That was a promise of my grandfather's, my father's. It's absolutely central to our firm. I have over $2 billion invested alongside our clients and the same companies. And we think that idea of sort of a family office, but we're a family office that is proud to be to have clients where we're aligned with their goals.
Yeah, well, certainly, I think investing side by side certainly brings a level of accountability and responsibility to your investors. And I think that's what makes you different, frankly, than a lot of other asset managers out there in the industry. So I think that's very commendable. Now, you and I've talked, volatility has really picked up in all indices, including the S&P 500. We even talked the last couple of years, things were going to be a little easier because interest rates were starting down, things were stabilizing. And then here we are today, we're not sure what interest rates are doing. It can be a post from POTUS and the markets will go down 800 points. It can be a new technology like DeepSeek and one goes up and then NVIDIA goes down 20%. So talk about your views on the volatility in the markets today and maybe how we should think about managing expectations for our clients out there and our listeners today.
Well, my wife used to say the secret to a happy marriage is low expectations. But I do think that's an important part of, in a sense, what an advisor's role is in educating clients, working with clients, is to help set realistic expectations. You know, we're not in a sales business. We're providing a service to a client. Yeah. And so that integrity and that management of expectations is such a critical cultural pillar. And I think the first expectation that always has to be set is that corrections, market volatility, that is an unpleasant but inevitable part of the investment landscape. So on average, the market declines over 20% every 3.5 years, mm-hmm. right? Over 10% every year. The average peak to trough drawdown in any given year is 14%. Now, that's normal. And yet when the market's down 14%, nobody's saying it's normal. There's right. CNBC specials. That's the first sort of general mindset. And then there's a specific mindset to the environment that we're in, which is that we have been in a period that is really never existed in human history, where money was free, where interest rates approached zero, and it created a lot of magical thinking. And I think we're in the beginning of an unwind from that I don't think we'll ever go back. That was really, it hadn't existed in all of recorded
really 14
history.
14 years, yeah. For the most part.
Yeah,
right?
We had 14 years of almost free money. Yeah. Yeah. And if you went back 2,000 years before that, it had never happened. Now, it hadn't happened for the simple reason that if I have a productive asset and I'm going to lend it to you, I lose the return on that asset. So I want you to pay me something for that foregone cost, that foregone return. So, that would be true if I had a herd of sheep and I lent you 10 sheep, you would owe me something for that. That's why money has a cost. It's not some magical Fed policy thing. It's just that idea and so zero interest rates was a huge shake. So we're transitioning out of 14 years of magical thinking. But at the same time, we're transitioning out of almost 50 years of a geopolitical approach that was based on globalization. And that change is also profound and far-reaching. It's happened before, but you'd really have to go back, you know, to World War I and things like that. So you have this rise of nationalization, deglobalization, geopolitical tension. That we're in a changing environment there. So think of that as transition number two. Monetary first, now geopolitical. And then we have a third transition, and that's technological, right? We are going through this massive technological revolution. And people who think they've picked the winners today, trust me, they haven't, right? You know, in 2000, we all knew the internet winners, right? It was AOL, Yahoo, and Cisco, right? And so, you know, this is a huge change in technology. It's going to disrupt some old business models in the same way the internet did. So those three transitions happening at the same time that you have an environment of complacency, high valuation, we think, you know, what's worked in the last 10 or 15 years isn't going to work in the next 10 or 15.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I was so excited about having this discussion with you today is we hear so much about technology, artificial intelligence, data centers, which, by the way, they're all the future, right? But at the same time, I think sometimes we forget about just the fundamental aspects of being smart about picking the right companies to pick. So maybe talk about the way you think about that, even with as we think about artificial intelligence and data centers, how going back to the fundamentals usually always win.
Well, John, you're so right. I mean, in a way, I feel like I have sort of a bipolar view. I have a lot of skepticism about the market as a whole because I think it's so characterized by this high momentum, unrealistic expectations and complacency. And yet, within that whole market, selectively, there are tremendous values if you focus on the characteristics of durability, resilience, valuation. So let me sort of flesh each of those out. In terms of the great expectations that are in the market, you know, it's amazing. If you were to say, what percentage of companies can hold an EBIT margin of above 50% for more than a decade? I think it's 0.2%.
Wow.
So when you look at the valuations of some of the big momentum market darlings, what were some of the Mag 7, people are projecting these high margins for another decade.
Right.
They've already had them for a decade. So you are down in things that are, you know, 0.1% of likelihood. Right. So the second thing is revenue growth. You know, if you're projecting 20% revenue for a company for the next 10 years, especially after they've done it for 5 or 10, you're down to like 3, 4, 5% of companies have been able to do that. 97% don't. So all of these expectations, high valuations in those areas. And meanwhile, you avoid those. You try to avoid the companies that are traditionally good value names, good places to hide, but the businesses are going to be changed by technology. Right. I mean, think of a world where we could have Anheuser-Busch, Estee Lauder, I mean, you know, high quality consumer companies that are down 50, 60, 70%, you know, Nike, things like that. So it is a dangerous time to just assume to swing arbitrarily. But if you're specific, you look for resilience. We have a portfolio today that's trading at 14 times earnings. It's grown faster than the market, faster than the S&P, and yet is trading at this steep discount. We think that's how I'm bipolar. I have this enormous optimism about owning a portfolio that's selective, resilient, durable, but avoiding the sort of what has worked, which has been this big momentum trade.
Right. So, you know, when interest rates went up not too long ago, I mean, I think I read an article by you saying that's probably not a bad thing for, especially if you're a stock picker, as opposed to just owning an index. And maybe this volatility that we've seen in the first quarter so far, year to date in 2025, maybe it's the same. How do you feel about interest rates going up and the volatility in the market for you at Davis Advisors, and how you feel like investing in that kind of in this environment?
Yeah, it's funny. There's so much time spent on market forecasts, on interest rate forecasts, and you know, people often overreact to short-term forecasts. And it's amazing if you look backwards at, you know, the people that are giving forecasts today and you say, well, did you predict the enormous interest rate increases that happened, you know, 2 years ago until last. Did you predict any of the geo? No, but people still want to react. So short-term forecasts are very dangerous. What I would say is that the 0% interest rate environment was so unnatural and created so many distortions that we simply viewed what happened since then as a return to normal. Now, will we have interest rate surprises in the future? I think almost certainly. It's like market crashes. You could get spikes up in inflation. I think if you asked me to bet, I would say that's the greater risk than going back to zero. But, you know, our basic view is over time, interest rates are like gravity. They sort of work across a portfolio. But spending time predicting them, you know, as we say, we don't want to predict, we want to prepare. And so what we say is we know that interest rates can be volatile. We know there's going to be a recession. We don't know when, right? We know there's going to be market crashes. We know there are going to be times that the credit market seizes up. Right. There's look at the uncertainty in the world. There's volatility. As you say, one tweet can change everything. Yeah. There have been terrorist attacks. There have been more. I mean, we just you have to be prepared. And that's where going all the way back to my grandfather, this idea of owning businesses that can adapt, owning businesses that have strong balance sheets, necessary products. I mean, you know, we've been, you know, buying companies that have been around for 50, 80, 100 years that have enormous durability and yet are trading at 13, 12, 13, 14 times earnings because nobody's that interested in those. They want the bright, shiny objects. Yeah. And we think that's the sort of the risk and the opportunity put together.
Yeah. You know, just hearing you say that, it you know, we get caught up in the day, in our day-to-day lives, especially when we watch TV. We're buying, you know, you think you're buying stocks. The reality is you just said you're buying businesses,
absolutely.
You know. And I think we lose track. And, you know, with all of the press today, it's about stock A, stock B. But the reality is an investor buys a business, not just a stock that happens to be on the screen.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the fact that stocks trade every day makes it easy for the end client to confuse changes in price with changes in value. And so they say, in fact, my sister, who's one of my favorite people on earth, and she's a small town doctor, rural California. And, you know, she's like, oh, you know, I really, you know, I feel a lot poorer because some stocks I own went down. And I said, well, that you're not poor. I mean, if you have to sell them, you have less, but the business values change much more slowly than the prices. And when you confuse and muddy those things, you get a real behavior penalty, right? In other words, when prices go down, if people get depressed and want to get out of the market, that's catastrophic. Right. In the same way, if prices go up and they get excited and say, hey, I should jump onto this NVIDIA bandwagon or whatever it is.
Right.
That's it's and that's why, you know, for 50 years, we built our firm in partnership with advisors because it's so easy for somebody on the outside to think that those prices moving around are a reflection of the underlying values. And it turns the end behavior into this sort of emotional response.
Right. Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. I mean, as we turn to the investor, right, it's this emotional-based investment philosophy sometimes is what I have found it gets people in trouble, right?
Yeah.
It's how do you take the emotions out of it to stay focused on the prize at hand, like picking the right companies to invest in?
Yeah, Morgan Housel, who's just a wonderful writer, he wrote that book. We both love The Psychology of Money. And Morgan talks about volatility. People think of it as a penalty, a fine. Like, oh my God, my stocks went down. I'm being punished. And he said, it's more of an admission. It's like you buy your ticket to get on this ride. And you don't think of, oh my God, that's a penalty. You say, no, it's my admission. And so the admission into the market, into being able to build generational wealth owning stocks, is having to have the resolve to absorb and put up with volatility. And it is where, you know, the habits and the perspective and the management, you know, that an advisor could provide. I would say when I think it was LaGuardia, when he was mayor, stood in front of the New York Public Library that has those two lions, and he named them this line we'll call courage and this one we'll call fortitude. And it was during the Depression. And I always think that's really the most important role of an advisor in trying to help manage that behavioral, the fear when prices are low, instead of being greedy, people are afraid.
Right.
When prices are high, instead of being nervous, they want to jump on. And so the advisor sort of provides that courage when they're down, the fortitude to stay, to resist those sort of siren songs. And that is one of the great advantages of stocks, is that those price changes can serve you if you have the right temperament and alignment. But it's one of the great risks, because it can really punish you if people end up having a behavior that's correlated with those changes in price.
And it reminds me, you know, you sit on the board of Berkshire Hathaway. I don't want to get into any, you know, confidential stuff, of course, but, you know, we've learned that's how, you know, Mr. Munger and Mr., you know, Buffett, that's how they think about it. I feel like they take the emotions out of it.
It's amazing. I mean, it is, you know, I've studied Berkshire. I mean, I've probably gone to annual meetings for, well, 35 years. I still have my first share of stock that I bought framed on the wall.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah,
it's starting to look like a Monet. I need a security guard to stand next to it. But, you know, everybody should read those annual reports. What's amazing about Warren and Charlie is, unlike, you know, some of the quant traders today that have all their hidden algorithms and they're terrified, they viewed themselves as stewards and as teachers.
Yeah.
And they were spectacular teachers about the principles of investing. And I can't recommend just simply reading the annual letters enough. And I feel, you know, outside of my father and grandfather, to have had these two incredible mentors and role models. Role models for their investment excellence, role models for their culture of stewardship, but also role models because they did what they loved. And they lived, they have, Charlie died last year, Warren's doing great, but it's this exuberant love of what they do. That's sort of the third pillar of it. So that culture of service and stewardship, a culture of excellence, of wanting to be the best at what you do, constantly learning, constantly getting wiser, and then coupled with this idea of really loving what you do. It's a powerful trifecta.
And staying true to who you are, right? I mean, it's evident that, you know, there's been plenty of opportunities for them to stray.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's just always staying true to who you are. And it works.
Yeah. Well, it is amazing how often people think, you know, getting stuff or changing their lifestyle is going to make them happier. And it's such a terrible trap. And it's one of the reasons I mentioned Morgan earlier, but it's one of the reasons I really recommend his book, The Psychology of Money, especially for young people, is it helps separate this idea of wealth from materialism. Because what you realize is that, what is the real definition of being wealthy? It's being able to do what you want with the people you want, when you want, for as long as you want.
Yeah.
And that number is very different for different people. And if you have a definition of wealth that involves owning a Lamborghini or owning a yacht, well, how does that affect the real definition, getting to do what you want with the people you want? And that separation of mindset, there's a great story about Joseph Heller, who wrote Catch-22, and he was with Norman Mailer at a party given by a hedge fund mogul out in the Hamptons somewhere.
Yeah.
And Mailer said to Joseph Heller, well, how does it make you feel that this guy whose party, you know, we're eating his hors d'oeuvres here, this guy probably makes more in a week than you made in your entire life? And Heller said, well, that man, I have something that man will never have. And he said, what's that? He said, enough.
Yeah.
Enough. And so that mindset around wealth, and it helps give you the patience, and looking at Charlie and Warren and, you know, not being able to do what they love, spend the time, their time doing what they love with the people that they love. That's a fabulous role model.
That's a wealthy person. We're going to come back to this at the end, because I think this is an important topic for us to end on as well.
Yeah.
But going back to today, we talked a little bit about current conditions, the emotions of the volatility of the market, how investors will be tested this year, certainly have been already. But what about the impact of tariffs? We've talked about a lot of interest rates and a lot of other things, but now we hear this word tariff, which we really haven't heard much of in the last couple, 20 years or so.
Yeah.
So tell us how you feel about that. Earlier you said you're heading up to Canada to see someone, and probably that'll come up, as a discussion.
Yeah, I'm going to go visit some energy companies up in Calgary later today. And it's part of that second transition. So, investors should have in their mind these three transitions, from the era of free money, from the era of globalization, and into the era of AI and this continuing acceleration of the technological revolution. And that'll affect biology, it'll affect all sorts of things. So tariffs is really a subset of that second transformation, this geopolitical transformation. And, what I would say is that tariffs are often viewed in almost religious terms. Oh my God, they're the worst thing ever. Free trade is the religion, or it's part of nationalism. It's what we need. Let's stick it to those guys that are taking advantage of us. And as with most fundamentalism, it's mistaken, right? There's much more nuance. So I've just finished a wonderful biography of Keynes, the economist, who really came of age right during World War I and helped as a young man avert a banking crisis in 1914, and then was at the Treaty of Versailles, predicted the inflationary consequences of that and the rise of, an amazing man, an amazing life. And there were times that he advocated for tariffs as ways of protecting not an industry forever, but making sure that you had good wages for your own domestic consumers, because that's a drive. So what I would say is we are in a time where there's going to be enormous overreactions. There's going to be terrifying headlines. There's going to be companies are going to have a hard time adjusting in the short term. And I think anybody that makes a portfolio decision based on what they think tariffs are going to be tomorrow or a week or a year or 2 years from now is making a mistake.
Yeah.
There's too much unpredictability. But what we would say is when we look at our own portfolio, we've had a bias towards things like US-based financials, some very high quality tech companies, where that's sort of not an issue. And so we like having that. If we own MGM, fabulous, so 60 or 70% of the Las Vegas Strip, tariffs isn't really sort of part of the thought process there. But when we think about copper, when we think about energy, when we think about inflation, it has to be in the mix. But what I would say is right now there's mud swirled up in the water. Everything is churning. Everything is changing. So focus on what you can control. Companies that are going to withstand whatever the environment is, they're going to get through an inflation shock. They're going to get through a recessionary shock. They're going to get through a terrorist attack. They're going to get, we want to own businesses that have that sort of durability, because things like tariffs have such unknown potential consequences.
Well, the U.S. markets have certainly proven to be resilient over the last two decades. There's no question. And I think that term durability is so apropos to what we try to do as financial advisors and investors, for sure. But with all of this noise out there, especially with the word tariff and the volatility, what's your advice to investors that have been sitting on the sidelines? I think I remember Peter Lynch saying, bear markets are short, bull markets are long, more money's been lost trying to time the market than being in the market over the, I may have gotten a little bit wrong, but what do you say to those clients that are sitting on the sidelines right now waiting?
Well, timing is a fool's errand. My grandfather said the best time to invest is when you have the money. You have to get started. It's the nature of compounding. Now, if I need to pay a tuition bill next year, I might say, well, I shouldn't be, banking on my portfolio being up 10% next year. It could just as easily be down 20, 30, 40, 50. But the idea that you're going to predict the recession and predict the timing to get out, we have a wonderful study at our place that shows that if you picked the worst possible time to get in the market before every crash of the last 50, 80, 100 years, if you were just able to hold on, you still achieved a very satisfactory return. Yeah. And the likelihood of getting that moment right. So what I tell people is, look, if you have a pile of cash and you're on the sidelines now, get started.
Yeah.
And just be systematic and get started based on your own temperament. If the idea of the market being down after you get in is terrifying, well, then maybe just do 10% a quarter and just average it. And that way, if the market goes down, you feel great. Oh, I'm only a little bit right. in. And if it goes up, you feel at least you got started. So that systematic investing works so well. And it's an area where I think advisors play a particularly strong role. It's helping people hear that, but then they forget to set it up and set the reminder. So I think that's it. But the other point to realize is just since the year 2000, I mean, John, this is so hard to imagine. Just since the year 2000, the purchasing power of a dollar is down 54%.
Yeah,
in my lifetime, it's down 88%. My grandparents' lifetime was down 95%. So people think sitting on the sidelines is safe, but it isn't, yeah. right? You're owning something that is devaluing every second that you own it. It's worth less. And there's scenarios where it could be worth a lot less. Wouldn't I rather own a business that's paying me dividends every year, that's global, can adjust? I mean, it's just, to me, it's sort of a no-brainer. But if the volatility is going to scare you, then simply just get started.
Right.
And don't try to time it. It's a fool's errand.
Well, this whole buying power of the dollar is a serious thing. I mean, you know, people are living longer today in the United States.
Absolutely.
And this longevity is an issue. And so, you know, one of our fears is that people outlive their money.
Yeah.
And being invested in the markets in a disciplined way will help, I think, combat that to some extent.
Well, so. And it's a real reason that, you know, sometimes clients get really wrapped up in the relative. Am I beating this benchmark? Am I beating that benchmark? And that goes all the way back to my grandfather's view of you need to be focused on generational wealth building. We always say, look, we want to beat the benchmarks over time, but job one is we want to build wealth. And if you told me over the next 10 years, I would go down 1% a year over the next 10 years, but the market would go down 3% a year. And the other scenario is we'll go up 10% a year and the market will go up 12. Which do I choose? Well, of course, I choose B, mm-hmm. right? Now, I want to beat the market, but job one, I want to make sure that the clients that entrusted us with their savings have more when they need those savings to fund their retirement and so on. And equities to me is just absolutely the right way. You know, you having fixed income that is depreciating year after year after year. And as I say, the zero rate environment created a lot of magical thinking. And there are people that didn't realize you could lose 30, 40, 50% in fixed income, you know, in long-term bonds. My grandfather called bonds certificates of confiscation. Well, because of course he started in 1948 with rates at 2,
sure. right.
and he watched them go to 20. Now, you know, it's interesting about timing. The last thing I'll say to this is my grandfather had perfect timing. He got into stocks in 1948. He became an ambassador in 1968. So he had to get out of the business from 1968. He got back in 1975 when his term as ambassador was up, right at the market low. So he Perfect. Just, he got in at the beginning of a bull market. He got out before. My father had the opposite. He started the firm in 66. We started the mutual fund in 68, right into the teeth of a bear market. You know, he was... you know, he was scared in 1975. He raised cash, so he didn't roar back the way my grandfather did. And yet they both did fabulously well. Yeah. So if you could have chosen my father's path, it would have felt more stressful, but it built wealth at the same wonderful rate.
Yeah. Well, we've seen over the last two decades immense wealth creation happen in the United States.
Yeah.
And we see with our clients, I mean, there's 77 million baby boomers in the United States today. They're getting older. They've accumulated this wealth. What advice do you give to that population who now has to make sure they protect it? I mean, we've all heard first generation creates it. The third generation sometimes or usually squanders it.
Don't rub it in, I know. I get told that very often.
But you do pretty good with it. But what advice would you, because I think a lot of people that will be listening to us today and watching us today are like, okay, how do I make sure that the wealth we've created last over generations?
Yeah. Well, a lot depends on the family value system to start with. So my grandfather turned $100,000 into $800 million in his lifetime. He gave 100% of it to charity, 100%. He didn't believe in inheritance at all. And there was a little bit of a carve-out exception for his daughter and her daughters where he created a trust for them. But it was nominal by anything relative to the wealth he created. And he had the Andrew Carnegie sort of view of it. My father was a bit more of a hybrid, but will probably, I would guess, by the end of the day, have given away 90% of every dollar he made, which is a staggering thing. So part of it depends on what is the family system. Now, I happen to be very proud of my kids, and I think that the most, you know, so I do intend to leave a portion of my estate to my kids. And I would say, to your point, the number one lesson is start early. You know, whether it's annual exclusion, trust, look, I would bet that inheritance taxes will be much larger 20 years from now than they are to today. I don't know that, but I think that's a good bet.
Right.
It is a crazy thing to write a check to the government for half or more of your estate, which I think was likely the most. So get started early. This is one of the great advantages of UBS, right? You have advisors that are like, well, let's talk about what sort of trust mechanisms there are. Let's talk about what sort of ways there are to avoid probate or to get started. And getting started early, it is amazing what a difference it makes. And so that is sort of my number one advice. But coupled with the idea that it likely will get much harder to leave money to your kids over time. So get started early and get great advice.
Yeah. You've told me that before that trust is such a strong word, and having the ability to trust people, including your kids.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And maybe that goes back to this whole idea of being transparent and getting them involved early, right?
Yeah. Well, and having integrity with them. Mm-hmm. You know, Warren has written quite a lot about this recently. You don't want your kids to be surprised by your will. Right. And if you're going to treat somebody differently or you've created different expectations, have that talk up front. It really, you know, I didn't love my grandfather less knowing that he wasn't going to give us any money. He said to me, I don't want to deprive you of the pride and the self-respect of making your way in the world. I was like, you could deprive me a little. but he had integrity in the process. And I think that is, you know, if you look at, you know, the Mungers, Warren had expressed his views about inheritance. Charlie's had different views. You know, I will say, Charlie used to say to me, you know, money doesn't ruin kids. You know, parents ruin kids. And so, you know, having integrity in the process, transparency, responsibility, flexibility, you know, I think though it's all sort of common sense, but money is such a difficult topic in families. Yeah. It's difficult in relationships. And so it's very hard to have those sort of transparent discussions. But I think that having that integrity, recognizing your kids are going to imitate you. And if you've lived a certain lifestyle, if you don't think your kids are going to be able to live that lifestyle, recognize they're going to feel like failures.
Yeah.
Because they aren't able to give their kids what they were given.
Right.
So I think that's a big part of the mindset. Is to now, you know, my dad traveled coach and we didn't go to Aspen or Southampton. So it didn't feel like, you know, it was going to be a huge, but if I had grown up on private jets and yachts and Palm Beach or something, it would be hard. And I've been able to earn my way into that. But my sister, who I mentioned earlier, you know, she's a small town doctor. Mm-hmm. She does not feel like a failure because she's given her kids the same life we had when we grew up. And so I think that's a mindset as you think about it. You know, do I want my children to feel like they're worse parents than me because they can't afford to give their kids a ski trip every year or whatever it is, or to send them to college? Mm-hmm. So my inheritance plans are sort of around that. I want to make sure that they can afford the lifestyle that I gave them.
You know, it's amazing. That reminds me of a conversation I had with one of our clients one day who was an accomplished executive. And he said, John, I can talk to the press. I can talk to the regulators. I can talk to the legal team. I can talk to my employees. But I have no idea how to talk to my wife or my children about our finances.
And
thank goodness we've built a business here at UBS where we have 30 trust and estate attorneys. We have over 20 people in the United States just talking about family advisory and philanthropy. So to your point, 20 years ago, we had one person doing that. But, you know, we've had to evolve the way we help our clients.
Well, and what's spectacular is that UBS has pulled my grandfather. I mentioned he was an ambassador. He was an ambassador to Switzerland. Mm-hmm. That is where he met my grandmother when they were students. And so we've always had this real admiration for the Swiss. And, of course, one of the things that is part of that Swiss culture is being able to talk about money in a thoughtful, responsible, long-term way. And so, you know, it's a different thing if you're at a, you know, what I'll call a U.S. investment bank, you know, it's, but that idea of that sort of trust bank ethos, that is sort of baked into the DNA of this place. And I think that is a great advantage because, you know, the Swiss are very pragmatic, they're very thoughtful, they're very discreet, and but they really think about, you know, wealth preservation over very, very long periods of time.
Yeah. One last question. I can remember, I don't know how many years ago, you and I were at an investor conference. We were sitting on a tiny little bench outside of the conference having one of our normal catch-up conversations. And I said something to you like, you know, Chris, what's next for you? What are you thinking about? And you said something to me. You said, you know, I don't really know, John, but I just try to live my life from living my funeral backwards.
Yeah.
I think I have that right.
You're exactly
And I've
right.
never forgotten that because I think, you know, our time together is always about how you want to leave this place better than maybe how you found the place. Maybe describe that in our closing commentary.
Well, it's you know, when I was in seminary, I worked for the church. And so I participated in a lot of funerals and a lot of weddings too. Some of those looked like a bad idea also, but that's a different story. And so very early, I started thinking about this idea of living life backwards. What do you want your funeral to look like? Who do you want to be there? What do you want them? You know, you don't want them, you know, showing up to make sure you're really dead. You know, it's they're, you know, and so I started thinking about what now David Brooks has called eulogy virtues, right? And those are different than worldly achievements. And so eulogy virtues are not about what you achieved, but the way you achieved it. And so, of course, I mean, I'm blessed because I love what I do. My grandfather used to say, I would love to die at my desk. And it wasn't because he didn't have a full life. It was because he also loved what he did. He said, I wouldn't feel more ashamed dying at my desk than I would dying on vacation because I love both. Both are components of my life. So that idea of starting backwards, starting at the end and working backwards, and you think, well, you know, I want to serve my clients. I want to be a great colleague. I want to be a great boss. I want to provide great careers for the people that work for us. I want people to feel they trusted us with their savings. They did well. I want to be a great father. I want to be a good husband, a good sibling, a good friend. I want to be part of my community and have people in the community feel like I contributed. And you know, so it is, it just, whenever I'm going through something, I think, well, what will I, if I'm looking at this decision, A, B, I think fast forward and I think, which will I regret not choosing more,
right?
So, you know, I have a chance to, you know, go on a trip with some friends, you know, say yes, you know, and because you'll tend to regret the things that you didn't do more than the things that you did. Our brains are very forgiving of decisions that we make that were wrong. If we made, you know, we rationalize and we think, well, and so don't live with that regret.
Wow, what a great way to end our discussion today. Chris, it's such an honor to be with you. You're a good friend. You're a better man. Thanks for being part of this industry and thanks for being part of this world. And for all of you watching today, thank you for spending time with Chris Davis and me today. It's been a fantastic discussion. And I want to thank all of our valued UBS clients. We're glad we can bring this interesting topic of insights, not just about investing, but about life and living with my good friend, Chris Davis. And we're looking forward to seeing you around. And maybe we'll get on that bench again one day and you'll give me some more words of wisdom. But thank you, everyone, and have a great day. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.